Coming up on Fronteras, one of the fastest growing cities in the Southwest is squeezing out pronghorn antelope.
You know, one of the things you hear about a lot is we've got to stop people from moving in. Well, these are the same people who moved here from somewhere else that are saying this. So, you know, that's not something that's going to happen. So you need to be realistic.
How to be realistic when it comes to pronghorn antelope and habitats. In his novel, The Feast of San Sebastian, San Antonio author Jonathan Marcantoni creates characters that expose the gritty, dark underworld of human trafficking in Puerto Rico.
Human trafficking is really symbolic of what Puerto Rico as a whole is experiencing, where no one is taking responsibility for actually helping to repair the problems of the country.
The author talks about his book, Puerto Rican Identity, and hope for the future. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. When we think of the West, we picture wide open spaces. But roads, new homes, and commercial buildings have cut across those spaces. And that development is having an impact on the pronghorn antelope, especially in one of the fastest-growing parts of the Southwest, Prescott Valley in northern Arizona. From the Changing America Desk, Laurel Morales reports.
Jim McClasland has lived in Prescott Valley for more than 5 decades, and he's watched it change from his front porch.
You stand here and look. You can see there's no buildings, there's no people. It was just wide open country.
And thousands of pronghorn antelope were free to roam. Today, the valley is packed with houses and strip malls. When McClasland bought a house, he decided to live on the outskirts of town to enjoy the wildlife.
But at the same time, I took habitat, and I consciously knew that I was doing that, but I also consciously did not put up a fence. This fence that my neighbor has affects movement of wildlife. It just does. But yet, people don't want javelina in their backyard tearing up their flowers.
I take a drive with the Arizona Game and Fish Department's Virginia Goldsberry and Zen Makarski. They show me how those fences fragment pronghorn habitat. We drive beyond the fences to where we hope to see antelope. I have my camera ready.
Okay, so you didn't want to look off to your right as we go through here.
We have trouble finding them. It's fawning season, so many females are bedded down, ready to have their babies. But there are also fewer antelope here today. Researchers once estimated 5,000 antelope in this area. Today, there are only about 1,000 in Prescott Valley.
We just drove past a subdivision called Pronghorn Ranch. What's your reaction to that? I mean, it's kind of ironic, huh?
Well, it'll be ironic if it all gets developed and there's no pronghorn out here. But, you know, 20 years ago, it was used as advertisement by a lot of the developers to, you know, say, come live at the pronghorn. And a lot of people moved here for it.
The antelope are unique. They're the fastest animal in North America. They can maintain speeds up to 60 miles per hour. But they're also very high strung. The idea of crossing a road overwhelms them. When Game and Fish has tried to relocate pronghorn, Makarski says a few typically suffer what's called capture myopathy.
For a human, it would be similar to a heart attack. They just overstress, and their heart begins to beat so fast, and it stops.
Back in the early 90s, Prescott developers built a subdivision where a large herd of pronghorn lived. Game and Fish tried to relocate some of the animals. A few died in the process. When people found out, they protested. Makarski says Game and Fish backed off, but warned that without relocation, the entire herd would die a slow death.
It took less than a decade for that herd of 129 to go from 129 down to 100, down to 90, down to 50, to the point today where there are zero. There are none left. And it just proves the do-nothing approach doesn't work.
He says the antelope died for several reasons. The animal's primary defenses are their tremendous eyesight and speed. They need wide-open grassland to see a predator coming. When antelope are confined to a small space, inbreeding becomes a problem.
One of the things that I hear a lot is, why do you all interfere with wildlife? Why don't you just leave them alone? I understand what people are saying, but they need to understand the bigger picture.
Bukarski says human development is the number one cause of wildlife extinction in the world.
We've already interfered with wildlife. If we want our children and our children's children to see the same animals and the same diversity that we get to see today, then we have to manage wildlife.
This winter, Game and Fish relocated 8 antelope from this area. Volunteers in southern Arizona removed almost 4,000 acres of mesquite and modified 50 miles of fences so the reintroduced antelope could crawl under them. Across the state, researchers are also working on building wildlife corridors over roads and through private land so the animals aren't so confined. In Prescott Valley, Bukarski and Goldsberry drive down a newly paved road when we finally spot a couple pronghorn way off in the distance.
Am I blind? I don't
right
see.
See.
Oh, I see him. You've got a good eye, Virginia.
I'm Laurel Morales, reporting in Prescott Valley.
It has now been confirmed that 2 camouflaged Mexican soldiers crossed into Arizona in January, touching off a standoff with U.S. Border Patrol agents. Both sides drew their weapons before the Mexican soldiers were detained. Frontera's desk's Lorne Madelon reports.
It happened January 26th, prompting a half-hour standoff 2.5 miles west of Sasabe, Arizona. After repeated denials that the Mexicans were military personnel, Mexico now says they were soldiers in pursuit of drug traffickers.
It happens a lot more frequently than you would think.
Border security analyst James Phelps from Angelo State University in Texas says it happens on an average of once a month.
You're facing somebody who's also uniformed in a dark-colored uniform and armed. And as far as you know, they're the cartel's recipients on the American side.
Phelps says there might be a simple explanation.
The border is very poorly defined and can be very difficult in some parts of the Southwest Desert area to know which side of the border you're on.
This time, however, a leaked incident report says the 2 soldiers had embroidered name tags that didn't match who the men said they were. No shots were fired, but questions remain. Why were the Mexicans on U.S. soil? Were they chasing traffickers? And why did Mexico deny for 3 months that the men were Mexican soldiers? I'm Lorne Madelon.
For the first time in almost 20 years, the Colorado River is flowing into northern Mexico and through a dam that usually stops it. It's part of an agreement between the Mexican and U.S. governments, as well as nonprofits in both countries. It's called a pulse flow, meaning a temporary release of water. Stina Sieg recently traveled across the border to see how the Mexican side is being impacted.
It's a sunny day at Morelos Dam, a mile outside of Los Algodones, just west of Yuma. It's also a momentous day. Like always, lots of water is still being diverted, rushing into canals and toward thirsty crops and cities. But some is also continuing through the dam and into a usually barren stretch of riverbed. It meanders some 70 miles to the ocean. It's a quiet, slow-moving body of water, but hundreds of people are here to cheer it on. That includes Michael Connor, Deputy U.S. Secretary of the Interior.
It also gives a sense of urgency to trying to negotiate a long-term agreement and build on this success. So we're relishing the moment, but we want to build upon it in building this partnership with Mexico.
That partnership will last for at least the next 3 years. That's according to Minute 319, an agreement signed by both countries. For the first time ever, it allows Mexico and the U.S. to share Colorado River water in shortage and in surplus. It also lets Mexico store water in Lake Mead, which helps keep the reservoir at needed levels. And a small portion of that is being released right now in one big 8-week burst. You can still see its effects about 20 miles away from the dam.
It's actually very cool.
Taylor Hawes with the Nature Conservancy is splashing her hand in the reawakened river. Her group is one of 6 nonprofits in the Raise the River campaign, which has an ultimate goal of seeing the Colorado reach the ocean once more. Hawes doesn't know if that will happen during this pulse flow, but she says this particular spot hasn't seen water in 17 years.
And you would never know that because it looks like a river. It's got tons of water in it. People are hanging out on the beaches. This is not an area normally they would be hanging out, but they're coming to see the river be a river again.
like Maria Sanchez, who came to see the flow with her family, including two youngsters who've never seen water here.
Ya al ratito que ya después ya que se le quite la gripita, pues entonces sí que disfrute todo esto.
They asked if they could take off their shoes and play, and she said, no, 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 but then they just let them go in and play, and how wonderful that they can enjoy this water being down here.
Nina Traceoff is translating. She's with the Sonoran Institute, another big player with Raise the River. A few miles away, over bumpy roads, her group is digging trenches to help the river reconnect near a spot called Laguna Grande. Workers are also digging holes to plant cottonwoods and willows, vital to reestablishing habitats for birds and other creatures. This is the front line in the Delta's restoration, and the Sonoran Institute's Edith Santiago explains that all kinds of people come to see it. Today, it's journalists and government officials. Not long ago, it was a troop of Boy Scouts. Santiago especially likes it when locals stop by.
They reconnect with the river, and then in that case, they will, take care of the area.
And it's benefited by the pulse flow, which ends May 18th. Right now, the Sonoran Institute and the rest of Raise the River are trying to generate funds to keep a small amount of water in the riverbed on a continual basis.
That was Stina Sieg reporting. There's still more Fronteras coming up. In his book, The Feast of San Sebastian, San Antonio author Jonathan Marcantoni creates characters that expose the gritty, dark underworld of human trafficking in Puerto Rico.
Human trafficking is really symbolic of what Puerto Rico as a whole is experiencing, where no one is taking responsibility for actually helping to repair the problems of the country.
Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Protests were planned around the country this weekend to commemorate what some estimate to be the Obama administration's 2 millionth deportation. But as Jujavi Block reports from the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, some on the other side of the debate are concerned the administration has been padding the numbers.
2 million, too many!
Stop the deportation!
A group of more than 25 activists from Phoenix began this march on Wednesday. The destination is more than 60 miles away, to a detention center in Eloy for immigrants facing deportation. The plan is to stage a rally there, one of dozens planned nationwide. One of the organizers, Natalie Cruz, says the message is this.
Let President Obama know that we're tired of all the deportations. 2 million is too many already.
There's that number again. At the 2 million deportation mark, Obama surpasses George W. Bush's record for his entire 8 years in office. Obama's tough enforcement strategy was a way to get comprehensive immigration reform to pass. But as that hope has stalled, frustration from advocates has grown. Last month, the president said he'd asked his administration to review immigration policies to see if they can be enforced more humanely. But not everyone is convinced the president's deporting enough people.
The truth is that interior enforcement has dropped dramatically, but the Obama administration has been able to mask that.
Jessica Vaughn is with the Center for Immigration Studies, a pro-enforcement think tank. She says this administration is juicing the numbers. When Immigration and Customs Enforcement put out record-high deportation stats over the past few years, they included migrants who were caught at the border and then deported. Vaughn says that's like combining apples and oranges.
They've taken the proverbial oranges, which are routine Border Patrol cases, painted them to look like apples, which are ICE deportations, and then boasted about a record apple harvest.
Last year, 64% of the more than 368,000 deportations were immigrants who'd been caught at the border. Vaughn says, meanwhile, immigration officials deported fewer people living here without papers.
That's a huge incentive for people to keep trying to come here illegally.
Vaughn says this numbers game has tarnished the Obama administration's credibility in the eyes of Republican lawmakers. ICE says its numbers include anyone deported from their custody. What's changed is more immigrants caught at the border are being transferred to ICE for formal deportation, while under previous administrations, they were often just returned across the border. So to recap, on the one hand, immigrant rights activists are mad because Obama has deported more people than any other president, On the other, immigration restrictionists are mad because they believe those deportation numbers were calculated differently than in the past.
So who's right?
Tanya Golash-Boza is a sociology professor at UC Merced who studied these numbers.
And the short answer is that there's some truth in the point of view of both sides.
Golash-Boza says the numbers are messy. So when I ask her if President Obama has deported more people from inside the U.S. than any other president, not counting people caught at the border?
We don't have the numbers to say yes or no because we don't have that information on any president or any administration prior to 2008.
Back at the march, activists say this numbers debate misses the point of what's happening on the ground. One of the marchers, Lourdes Hernandez, has a husband detained inside the Eloy Detention Center. He's been there for over a year trying to fight deportation. The government keeps separating families every single day, she says. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
Puerto Rican author and San Antonio resident Jonathan Marcantoni makes an appearance at the San Antonio Book Fair this weekend. Jonathan Marcantoni's book, The Feast of San Sebastian, was just released in Spanish as an ebook. It was published in English first. The Feast of San Sebastian is a no-holds-barred story about the complex, brutal, and far-reaching effects of human trafficking and labor trafficking in Puerto Rico. Marcantoni told me he spent a lot of his childhood and teenage years going back and forth to Fajardo, Puerto Rico, where his family's from. His time there helped inform and set the scene for his book.
Well, the Feast of San Sebastian is about human trafficking in Puerto Rico as well as the political corruption. And the idea behind it is that Puerto Rico is a society where culpability is completely gone. People are always passing the buck as to who is responsible for this injustice or that problem. And so human trafficking is really symbolic of what Puerto Rico as a whole is experiencing, where no one is taking responsibility for actually helping to repair the problems of the country.
Now, this book is fiction, but you seem to draw on a lot of the politics of Puerto Rico. And how did your experience and spending a lot of your childhood play into the narrative?
Most of the personal information came in the form of Elon, the main character's relationship with his grandparents and his experiences growing up. And most of the book was actually based on a study called, in English, it's Human Trafficking in Puerto Rico, Challenge to Invisibility. And that study was published in 2010, and it covered the various trafficking operations in Puerto Rico. And the political side, I was always very interested. When I was 15, I actually got to see, because Fajardo is right by where Culebra and Vieques are. And when I was 15 was when Vieques was in the midst of an uproar because they were trying to get the Marines out of there. And so I got to see one of the marches protesting the Navy presence on Vieques.
There's a lot of violence in this book,
yes.
And it's very brutal. And some of these characters that do just the unthinkable, you have a way of making us, I don't want to say be on their side, but kind of see where they're coming from. And what were you trying to do with that?
Well, what was always important to me was maintaining the humanity of the characters. So even someone like Nano, who by all measures is a complete psychopath, he has a reason for being that way. And I think that, especially in American society, there's a real tendency to just dehumanize anyone who commits a crime and also to dehumanize the poor. And so my goal with this book was to show whether they were good people who were just hardworking people who had bad luck in life or whether they were criminals, that these are still human beings. They still have a purpose in society, and they shouldn't be just devalued.
There's a lot of Puerto Rican pride in this book and anti-American sentiment. And is that what people that you know there, is that how they feel? And can you explain that sentiment and feeling?
Well, there's a mix. I mean, you will find most Puerto Ricans, even if they like the United States culture in general, the United States is still a far-off place. Puerto Ricans don't identify themselves as Americans. They identify entirely as Puerto Rican, but at the same time, they're wholly dependent on America. And I think what it comes down to is that America, or whatever its flaws, is more trustworthy than the institutions and local government. And so people look to the United States simply because they can't look at their own people to help them out. And the nationalism, I very firmly believe that Latinos have a very distorted worldview that just hurts them, because the worldview that a lot of Latin Americans have are, well, if nothing else, I can just migrate. You know, if things are going bad here, I can just migrate to the U.S. and everything will be fine. And in Puerto Rico, this is made even easier because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. And what this mentality does is it causes a brain drain, because why bother investing in your own country when you can just go to somewhere else and take care of yourself? That sort of lack of investment, personal investment in our own societies, is what ultimately harms us. And I wanted that to be very front and center with this book, that even though all these bad things are happening, even though there are things like corruption, you know, there's one character, he says, you know, we have corruption, but we are not corrupt. And that's a very important point in the book, is that simply because we have problems doesn't mean they can't be fixed, but they cannot be fixed if we're only looking out for ourselves.
Do you want to live in Puerto Rico?
I do. I do. I want to be able to live there and raise my family there and have my kids know the island. But there also needs to be opportunity. I can't just take them there and have no jobs, you know?
I couldn't help but think of that when I was reading your book. Some of the Puerto Rican identity and this feeling of selling out if you go to the U.S. for more opportunity. But you are here. You're in the military. You're writing a book. You have raising your family here.
Yeah, and that's one of those big contradictions. And, you know, I'm in the military for financial reasons. It was the job that I could get at the time. And it presents me with a lot of internal conflict.
What is your conflict?
My conflict is that my real love and my real passion is the island.
Jonathan Marcantoni is author of the book, The Feast of San Sebastian. You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.